are live.
Yay.
Okay, we'll just wait a few minutes. As people hop on, if you would like to say hello so that we know that you're here and can hear us and see us okay, that would be good. Making sure everything works.
Yeah. Technology is so amazing and challenging at times. So yeah, it's good to make sure everything's connected here. Hopefully folks will join us soon and can give us a thumbs up if they can hear us.
All right. See a couple people hopping on now. Say hello if you want to. Can you see us and hear us okay? Hi there. Thanks for joining. We will. Oh, good.
Do we have confirmation that we are?
You can see and hear us well. All right.
Awesome. Great.
Although, let's see. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Great. Okay. It looks like we've got some people. Hello from LA. For some reason, it's not showing names, but
okay.
That's okay.
Just so folks know, we won't be replying to them by their name.
Yeah.
We don't want to. But yeah, it just says Facebook user, but that's perfectly okay.
Okay. So what I'm going to probably look at my phone. So that's what I'm doing.
Yeah, sure.
And I can see names on my phone. That's weird that I can't over here, but, all right, you guys, welcome. If you hop on, just continue to say hi. We're going to go ahead and get started. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm really excited to bring this to you guys, today. And this is Brian Peck with me here today. I reached out to him a few weeks ago. This is a topic that is kind of near and dear to my heart. I have personal experience with it. And somehow, I don't know, a while back, probably, I want to say like 6 months ago, I think I found you on Instagram originally, with the Room to Thrive. And I really just was blown away with your content and that you were talking about this subject, which I often talk about as the subject that we're going to be talking about today and diving into is forgiveness. Just a forced forgiveness is just not required and simply really doesn't work.
Yeah.
And we find that, you know, that situation in religion, you know, religious groups, as well as I come from kind of the spiritual new age group where it's also very prominent in those groups as well. And I think it just in society in general, especially when it comes to your parents, right? So we're going to be diving into that today. And then if you guys, if you have questions, if you could save them closer to the end, we're probably going to go an hour, maybe a little longer, depending how many questions we have. And if you want to kind of hold them until near the end, we will answer them. It's just if you start putting the questions in now, they might get buried. So that's just a suggestion. If you want to wait until a little bit closer to the end, we'll get to questions. So and I'm sure you guys have a lot of questions. I'm excited to get started with this. So I'm just gonna tell you a little bit about Brian here. So Brian is in Boise. You're in Boise, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, here in Boise. And actually, I'm looking out my window here and there's a thunderstorm rolling in, it looks like. So
hopefully
the connection is stable. Yeah,
hopefully so. Brian's an LCSW. And that's a licensed clinical social worker, for those of you that might be wondering what that is. And he helps survivors resolve their religious trauma. And you've got a practice there in Boise and online. And then in addition to his clinical work with trauma, he offers trauma-informed coaching, online. So anyone with adverse religious experiences. So we're going to talk about that a little bit too, what that means. High demand religious communities. Yeah. So this is super duper exciting. Brian is, we'll have all his information in here at some point, probably near the end. He's got a fantastic, your Instagram, Room to Thrive, really great content, articles on these subjects like forgiveness that are just really, really potent. And the Religious Trauma Institute. I just thought that was just so relevant. And I just, so all of that's going to go up, and you can, you know, definitely reach out to Brian and get his contact information. But I want to go ahead and start in with today's topic, which is really that, you know, breaking down why forgiveness isn't really necessary for trauma resolution, and why that forced forgiveness, you know, which often is the first thing that comes out of someone's mouth, is just, oh, you just gotta forgive. Especially when we're talking about parents that harmed us, yeah. Right? So maybe we can just start there.
Yeah, sure.
Does that sound good to you?
Yeah, for sure. I hope that this can be just kind of a free-flowing conversation. Yeah. I did throw together a few slides if that's useful to kind of guide our way. But yeah, I'm really wanting to respond to, you know, the questions that folks have, and just kind of dive into the topic. So, yeah.
Super. Yeah.
One thing that you mentioned is how forgiveness is often expected, and it's often linked to like it's the sign of having resolved your trauma, like, you know, you achieved, you know, healing if forgiveness is there. And, yes. And as you mentioned, that kind of forced quality to we're expected to forgive, it can be re-traumatizing. It can be harmful, and it's often weaponized against us, especially inside of kind of religious communities where, it functions in a way that's not helpful or safe for survivors. And it's a really difficult topic to talk about because there's so much connected to it. You know, Christianity, my own kind of background is within a fundamentalist sect of Christianity. And forgiveness is like central to the Christian doctrine and message. You know, Jesus forgave and God forgives us, and there's this pressure expectation that in order to be accepted within a group, you need to forgive. And like we're talking about, that can serve many functions. And when we begin to point out, you know, the dark side of forgiveness, it makes people uncomfortable because it requires us to acknowledge that forgiveness can have, you know, many functions. And so, I'm just really excited to be talking about this and sharing kind of my perspective on it, what I've learned, both in my own personal experience through a bit of study and research, and also working with survivors. The messages I hear from survivors when it comes to forgiveness, it's just heartbreaking to see the unnecessary additional suffering and re-traumatization that happens when, you know, forgiveness is weaponized and wielded against survivors.
That word weaponized, you know, it's just that could be used. And I think that what we, you know, that shame and guilt we've already feel for a multitude of other reasons. And then the first thing out of somebody's mouth is, well, you got to forgive, you know, and everything will be fine if you just forgive. And the onus is always put on the survivor of that situation. And what most, you know, most of my clients, they have real harm as well as, you know, yours, that their parents hurt them in some way. And that for, you know, hearing that you just got to forgive them. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of us have even tried that route, right? Because nobody was validating or telling us anything different. So I thought, well, there must be something wrong with me if I don't want to forgive.
Yeah. Yeah, I think when you think about how shame is often connected to trauma, you know, I know you talk about trauma, and folks listening in probably have a fairly, you know, good understanding of trauma. But just to kind of give a simple definition, you know, trauma is often the result of an experience where you needed to do something to defend or protect yourself. You needed to say something, to do something, to be safe in the world, but you were unable to, often because of circumstances, systems out of your control. And that can result in a variety of different kinds of trauma responses that are ongoing until it's resolved. But a common one is that a feeling of powerlessness, or the freeze collapse response.
Yes.
And when we think about what that feels like, it really feels like shame. And in fact, working with survivors, you often hear folks try to gain some sense of control over an event that was clearly out of their control. But if they can blame themselves, then at least there's the hope that they can change themselves and somehow make it better. Yeah. And we can see how that can get us trapped, where the situation was not in our control. There was nothing that we could have done. And to add that layer of shame on top of that, and I think, you know, forgiveness can function in a similar way. It's this pressure to do something that you're unable to do. And then you feel less than or shamed, or this sense of there's something wrong with me. I should be able to do this forgiveness thing because, you know, everyone else says it's important and it seems so easy. So that feeling of powerlessness that is reinforced by those kinds of experiences, as opposed to focusing on what does the survivor need to feel stronger again, to feel safer again, to feel more connected again, beginning to do that, that healing work that may or may not result in forgiveness, but it gives at least the potential for something like forgiveness. Yeah. I'm not here to defend forgiveness or to make a strong case for it, because I think it has a lot of different functions. And when we kind of start with the survivor and what they need first, and kind of prioritize that sense of safety, then a lot of different things can result from that. And in some cases, that'll be not offering forgiveness to others. In some cases, it'll we'll have enough safety, enough distance, in order to have a different reaction or response to those who harmed us. But again, as soon as we infuse a bit of pressure or expectation on top of that, it really undermines the potential for that to be a safe and viable path forward. And it's really important to notice how that shame can be connected to forgiveness. And it makes an already really isolating and disconnected experience even more kind of, you know, disconnected and alone.
So true. Yeah. And, you know, the way I work somatically, we've got to get through all the layers of all these underlying feelings, right? That might be that, you know, a lot of times there's a lot of anger. And what I always say is you can't just slap a forgiveness band-aid on anger and grief and loss.
Yeah.
And all of those emotions in there that never got processed, right? So you got to forgive and just bypass all of those other valid experiences and feelings. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, you bring up the topic of anger, and I'm really passionate about this topic as well, because I think anger has been so, you know, demonized and stigmatized in our culture. And I think especially I work with, you know, folks who've been harmed inside of religious communities and inside of patriarchal systems, especially, you know, as a society in general, we're uncomfortable with aggression and anger. But when it comes to how we treat, you know, women, particularly, where if you're angry, we'll dismiss you, or we'll say, you know, you don't, you know, you're out of control or emotional, mm-hmm. or, but when, you know, a cishet white man is angry, we're like, oh, you know, leadership quality and, you know, rah, rah, let's go. And it, we think about what happens when we don't have access to this fight or flight response. And all we're able to do then is to move into this freeze, collapse, or please, appease physiology. And essentially, organizations, communities that don't allow their members to have access to anger, to aggression, it's kind of really powerful survival response. They're forcing them to live inside of this, you know, survival physiology of a freeze, collapse. And I think as a result, there's all this kind of baggage around anger, and it feels like it's something to be gotten over. You know, we shouldn't feel that. From a survivor's perspective, it often feels risky or dangerous, especially if anger has been has resulted in, you know, some kind of adverse response from others. And so we don't have the, you know, experience of trusting ourselves inside of aggression. But in my experience, aggression, anger, is not only helpful, but often it's essential to restoring a sense of strength and power, which then results in safety. And I'm a big fan of the polyvagal theory. And when we think about how our nervous system is organized, that freeze-collapse response is kind of the last resort when a nervous system doesn't have any other option. And then if we want to move to a place of feeling safe and at ease again, it requires us to go into and through this activated fight or flight response. And so when survivors begin to access that anger, that aggression, and they're pushed back down, or it feels too risky, or there's not enough support around that, then we start to live inside of this freeze collapse response. And we think about how forgiveness functions in this way. You know, just get over it, get past it, you know, feel better. And that can serve a survival function in terms of you get to live another day as long as you go along with what's expected, but you don't get to be free. You don't get to be alive. You don't get to be, you know, really connected to the sense of safety in your life. And so when it comes to anger, we want to be able to harness that survival energy, to use that to regain a sense of control and power again. And if we're able to do that effectively, and we can neutralize the threat, defend ourselves effectively, and this isn't always, you know, face-to-face with the person who harmed you, but restoring a sense of that aggression and power, that can allow us to trust ourselves again. And our nervous system will allow us to feel at ease when we are able to express that in a very powerful way that that becomes embodied in our experience. And, and so I'm a huge fan of anger. I'm not such a big fan of forgiveness always. But anger is amazing, and it can be a really useful resource for us.
Powerful.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Really is. Love that. Totally with you on that. I think another thing that I'm, you know, really passionate and about, you know, dissecting is this notion that we have to sit at the table with our abuser and pretend like nothing happened, right? Especially in the family unit. But again, in the family unit, and then also in society at large, and certainly I would assume in religious circles.
There's a common kind of message about forgiveness, where you're required to forgive in order to be forgiven. You're required to forgive in order to be part of the community. If you don't, you become a threat to the community. And so, again, there's that pressure, that kind of, you know, obligation to offer forgiveness. And instead of focusing on what does a nervous system need to feel safe and okay, which could result, you know, there's at least the potential for some restoration of relationships, not always, and certainly not when it's harmful to you ongoing. But if we're able to effectively provide that support and hold people accountable and responsible for their behaviors, put into place structures that protect and defend folks, then we're creating a context in which forgiveness might be an option for folks. Instead, to put all of the focus on a survivor needs to, you know, forgive so that the community, you know, benefits from, you know, protecting the reputation. They don't have to deal with the, you know, the difficult process of seeking justice and creating a context of safety.
Yeah.
All that additional weight and pressure is placed on the survivor. You need to do this thing for the community. You know, how dare you tarnish this person's reputation by insisting that they take responsibility for the way they harmed you? And when we begin to force people into situations where they have to do that, you know, there's, I work with a lot of folks from the LDS community, the Mormons or Latter-day Saints, and there's this thing that happens throughout your adolescence and even into adulthood where you go to this worthiness interview and this, you know, lay minister, this deacon or bishop rather, ask you these really personal questions, and you are required to, you know, confess to them, to share details about your life that they have no business knowing. And there's a lot of abuse that happens inside of these settings, as you might imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And then to be forced into those situations, like you said, be forced to sit at the table with your abuser. But that's the way to salvation. That's the way to acceptance in the group. And so we can see how that just places an incredible, you know, burden on the survivors and doesn't provide the safety that's required for them to be, to heal and move forward. And yeah, it's super unfortunate.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a lot of clients and people in my group that will talk about, you know, and wanting to be part of that family unit. Right, because when you take yourself out of that, when you speak up, when you say, hey, wait a minute, this is not okay, they literally lose their entire family.
Yeah.
Nobody's on their side.
Mm-hmm. And from a survival perspective, you know, that could be devastating. And so what does a nervous system do when faced with there's this harm that I'm enduring, and then there's the potential of not surviving, you know. I think we talked about shame a bit earlier in this kind of some of the evolution of shame, because it allowed groups to maintain cohesion and order. And shame was a really powerful force to keep people in line. If you were to be kicked out of the group, or the group were to reject you, it wasn't just like it is today where, well, I can find other ways of surviving. I can connect to other groups, find other resources. The felt sense of that was, I'm toast, you know, I can't survive on my own. And the community was so important to our evolution as humans that, and that's why folks will often tell me that they're puzzled by how strong a response they had to leaving the church you know, a family has, you know, shunned them. And when we think about that kind of really visceral, instinctive response that we have to that, it really goes back to this, you know, need to survive. And our nervous system is, you know, doesn't understand always that, you know, in today's world, we have options and choices maybe. And so we go to that place of this feels completely overwhelming and not safe for us.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So powerful.
Yeah.
Do you want to go into slide mode?
I can, yeah. We've covered some topics already. I've kind of been clicking through as we're going here, but I'll share my screen. Like I said, I just kind of put some of these ideas together to kind of be something to fall back on if we need to, but let me go ahead and share my screen real quick here.
Yeah.
See if I can do that. Yeah, let's see, is it working? It's trying to work, here we go, share screen. All right. Is that showing up now? Not yet.
Yes, it is there. About to screen. Okay, there.
Okay, here we go. Awesome. Yeah. So, you know, we've covered a few topics already, and so we might jump around here a bit. But I think For me, one of the most helpful ways of understanding forgiveness is to take it off of the kind of religious pedestal that it's on and to see it in terms of, you know, its survival function. How does it benefit humans, and how might it be harmful for humans? We can then take a more, you know, functional approach to it, a more nuanced approach. It's not that it's universally helpful and required, but that it can be useful in, you know, everyday misunderstandings and slights that we experience as humans. I have, you know, a 6-year-old who I forgive a lot because, you know, he'll be, you know, break something or knock something over. And it makes sense that we evolve this ability to kind of remedy some of those things that could, you know, make a relationship stressful or challenging. And so, but when it comes to abuse and things that, situations where we're not safe, you know, forgiveness doesn't have the same function for us. And so I think, just recognizing that, you know, revenge is not a disease and forgiveness is not a cure, which is the typical religious model for forgiveness. Mm. In fact, forgiveness is seen as supernatural in that respect. And we've kind of talked about this a bit already, but it bears repeating that, you know, forgiveness is not a virtue outside of a context of safety. You know, as we really talked about, when a survivor is, you know, bearing the burden of, you know, keeping the community safe and, you know, protecting the image, and nothing is being done to ensure their safety, you know, forgiveness, because yeah, that could be really harmful for folks.
Again,
this is, you know, we mentioned this as well, when forgiveness is tied to salvation or acceptance in a group, that pressure is just really, really, really unhelpful. I think these next three slides were a light bulb moment for me. A lot of my understanding of forgiveness has come from Michael McCullough's book, Beyond Revenge, The Evolution of the Forgiveness Instinct. And I can't recommend it highly enough. Unfortunately, it's a hardcover book. I think there's only a few available on Amazon. So it's not widely available, unfortunately. It's such an important work. You can hear he's done a few interviews. If you search his name in your podcast platform, you might find he did a really fascinating interview on Krista Tippett's On Being podcast. I can't recommend that highly enough, where he kind of breaks down how revenge evolved, how forgiveness evolved, what functions they serve. Okay. And so looking at it through this lens of how it functions, we can begin to do what's required to create conditions where it might be a safe and viable option for folks. And so let's just look at these three different things. So careworthiness, when we view the person who has harmed us, and again, I know your audience is primarily folks who have, you know, dealt with narcissistic abuse typically, and but we're talking in this context about kind of forgiveness in kind of broad terms. So if your transgressor, if we view them as worthy of compassion, which we'll see in the second and third slide here, that there'll be some things that need to happen before that's an option often. But it's easier to forgive someone that we view as, you know, deserving care, which family members, when they're not toxic and abusive, typically are deserving of care. And that's why forgiving my 6-year-old is pretty easy.
Exactly.
So the second condition, we are more likely to forgive someone if there's an expected value. And so this gets complicated, though, when you think about in a religious context or in a family context, there might be this feeling of, you know, well, I need my parents to survive because I don't have the resources as a child to make it on my own. And so, again, there can be some pressure here. Like, there's this expected value, which is why I think the third quality, to me, is central to both of these being available to us as options. So, but if we think about the expected value, if someone if there's no kind of redeeming qualities, if we don't aren't getting additional resources from them, if they don't benefit our survival, we're less mm-hmm. likely to forgive them. That's just kind of how that works. Mm-hmm. This one is the big one. I think this one is central to forgiveness being an option.
Absolutely.
And I think once we understand that safety is central to forgiveness being an option, then when we're pressured to forgive, our response can be, you need to do the work for me to feel safe. And then we can talk about forgiveness as an option. Mm-hmm. We need to have that safety. And so when we think about if the person who harmed us is no longer able to harm us for whatever reason, and there's been, you know, enough safety created in that context where they can't harm us again, that again increases the potential for forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And so forgiveness isn't this magical thing that right. can just, you know, transform, you know, abuse and harm or trauma into, you know, I'm healthy and safe and okay again. Doing the work of resolving trauma, creating a context in which you're safe again, can create an opportunity where forgiveness might emerge from that. It doesn't always have to, but it might. But we have to do what's required first. Otherwise, you know, forgiveness often becomes harmful and toxic.
Yeah.
As we kind of talked about these three things, you know, maybe some reactions or responses to that. What kind of stood out to you?
Yeah. So I think, you know, in terms of like family members, parents, if, you know, just forgive them, right? That's your mother. Just forgive, forget, move on. But there's been no work on their side or no effort, or, you know, maybe they're a narcissist, maybe they have a mental illness or a personality disorder or addiction issues, you know, any of those scenarios. And there's been, but there's been no effort on their side, right?
Yeah.
They're still operating in their space of trauma and whatever it is. And then the adult child is, you know, maybe still trying to seek out that love and approval and have a relationship, right? But they're, and then maybe the person, the parent, the mother or the father might show some slight signs of change, but it's very short lived, and then they're back in their patterns, right?
Yeah. And so what does safety look like in that kind of context, right? I would say there needs to be at least some predictability. There needs to be, some shift in behavior that can result in the feeling of I can trust this, and maybe not very much at first, but if the person who's harmed you is doing the work to allow you to trust them a bit more. And again, you know, with a person who's a narcissist, their motivation for changing is not very high, and their ability to fake changing or to tell you what you want to hear as a way of gaining access to you, you know, it's really difficult to trust that. And so, we can see how that the potential for forgiveness when you can't ensure your own safety, it's pretty low, and it's no fault of your own. And I think that's the message that I want survivors to know, that there's this cultural expectation that you forgive. But the society is not doing the work for that to be an option for you. That's not on you, right? That's on the system surrounding you. That's on the family members. That's on the structures that are in place that are preventing you from feeling safe again. And there's only so much we can do to gain a sense of our own safety while still maintaining a relationship that's harmful to us. And so when, you know, I know you support folks who are in no contact with toxic family members or parents, that might be the only way to feel safe. So if forgiveness results from that, so be it. But it wouldn't be surprising to me if it doesn't, because that level of safety is not there. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why I always, you know, give people options, you know. If forgiveness, I always say it's an organic process. If organically, somewhere down the road, it feels like an option that feels pretty good to you, then, yeah, you know, go for, you know, feel into that forgiveness, absolutely.
Yeah, sure.
And even with no contact, I always say, you might want to just try it out for a while. It doesn't have to be permanent. Just give it a try and let your nervous system take a break from all the chaos and drama going on, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And take you a know, step back from that.
Yeah. It reminds me of, I think that what you're describing is when we do what's necessary to feel safe and powerful and connected in the world, then there is the possibility of forgiveness ensuing from that. It reminds me of Viktor Frankl's work, Man's Search for Meaning, and he talks about happiness in a similar way.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of baked into our American culture, at least, the pursuit of happiness, you know, like this is the thing to do is pursue happiness,
right.
Which is a bit of a fool's errand because happiness will always be one step ahead of you. And when you, the more you pursue it, the more out of reach it is. If we connect to what's meaningful and we do what matters to us, sometimes happiness results from that, but not always, and it doesn't have to.
Yeah.
But when we make our life about pursuing happiness, it often eludes us. And I think forgiveness is a very similar experience. It requires us doing the work to create a context in which it may emerge. But when we try to force it, you know, then you know, we can kind of try to force happiness, but it becomes very shallow and disconnected and fleeting. And I think forgiveness is you know, function it's in a similar way. It's that kind of, you know, spiritual bypassing or this, you know, we just want you to feel better. It's all about feeling better. In fact, let me just skip back here. Yes. I had some definitions of forgiveness back here. Yeah, and so, so what is forgiveness? There's this, the intentional and voluntary process by which a victim undergoes a change in feelings and attitudes regarding an offense, and they overcome negative emotions such as resentment and vengeance, however justified it might be. To forgive is to cease to feel resentment against an offender, to give up resentment, to stop feeling anger towards. In as as a therapist, as a student of, you know, human behavior, one thing I know about feelings is when we try to feel a certain way, we're going to get caught up in a struggle. And, you know, it's like trying not to think of a pink elephant. The harder we try not to do that, the more it shows up. And so when we're trying to muscle ourselves into certain feelings, we're going to stop feeling a certain way. Our brains didn't evolve with erasers. They didn't evolve with backspace or delete buttons. You know, it's our just the way our brains work. It's additive. We can add new experiences and have new kinds of connections to the old experiences, but we can't just stop feeling a certain way. And when we think about if that's what we mean by forgiveness, that you are supposed to stop feeling a certain way.
Even
if we were to agree that that was important, the way we would achieve that would not be trying to force it. Because, you know, when I try not to feel anxious, you know, we were kind of joking before the live stream here that there's always these kind of butterflies and jitters and, you know, this is important to us. We want to be helpful and useful in this presentation. And there's a bit of pressure that we feel around that. And I've learned myself that if I try not to feel that way, I keep get more and more constricted and this isn't safe and I'm not okay and don't feel anxious and just calm down. And like, oh no, it's, you know, it's really bad. And it kind of it feeds on itself. And so if we want to shift how we feel, then we need to create the context in which that's possible. I offer some safety to myself and I'm sitting here with my hands in my stomach and noticing that I'm safe and okay. I've looked out the window and noticed the trees out there. And there's a context in which I can begin to feel a bit safer.
Yeah.
And when I can do the aggressive, powerful, forceful things to defend myself or to protect myself from an abuser, there's a potential that that's going to result in different feelings towards that person. Absolutely. But if I go at it from the perspective of I need to change my feelings, which it sounds like based on these definitions, that's what forgiveness is about.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I want to share one thing. I'm sorry, I'm really geeking out about this. there's this, now it's going to elude me. I'll let it just show up again. Oh yeah, there's this belief or this idea that, you know, forgiveness isn't for your abuser. Forgiveness is for you. It's for your own.
Yes.
And let's just notice that for a moment. Like, what does
that even mean?
What does that even mean? Like, it's for me, it's not for the other person.
Yeah.
And again, that begins to feel a bit like, you know, this self-serving almost. The culture, the structures around me don't need to account for the way they've harmed me. Nothing needs to change in the environment. I just get to feel differently.
Yeah.
There's some denial there. There's some avoidance there. We're not connected with this larger context in which we live, and nothing has to change about that. We just need to feel better. And again, that even if it were possible, like, what is the outcome of that? Can I trust that?
Yeah.
Can I trust that? What my nervous system knows is that this context, this relationship is unsafe to me, and I have lots of experience and evidence of that being the case. Yeah. And then if I were to somehow even magically be able to feel differently about that, you know, does my nervous system have what it needs to trust that? Mm. And instead of that, you know, it's trying to change how I feel, or it's just for me, we need to place this in a bigger context. You know, what needs to happen in our society in order for me to feel a bit safer? What needs to happen in this relationship for me to feel safer? And I don't need to be the one doing all the work. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Wow. I love that. Really good points there. And just that it kind of, well, I always like put it in the category of the toxic positivity.
Yes, it's very much that. Yes.
You can't feel any of that. And again, it's that whole thing of just really being disconnected from our bodies.
Yes.
And people not understanding that there's just it's just so much more complex and so many layers and that's why none of that really works, or it's not any long, you know, lasting change that would benefit me, right? Mm-hmm. And what I'm really feeling. And again, I'm suppressing what happened to me and what I'm feeling, and even trying to put words to it. It's, you know, just further suppressing, and then, you know, the shame and guilt
I would never put it on a survivor to need to do the additional work of making society a better place. In my experience, a lot of folks who have experienced trauma or abuse in a setting, they don't want anyone else to feel what they felt, to experience what they experienced. And when we say, oh, no, forgiveness is just for you, you know, just you can feel peaceful and happy and okay again, so let's just do whatever's necessary for you to feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
We're disconnecting them from what often feels like a really strong desire for justice and for safety. And it sounds, you know, maybe kind and compassionate, like, oh, I just want you to feel better. And meanwhile, a survivor often wants the world to be better, and they don't need to feel better as much as they need to make sure this doesn't happen to anyone else, to make sure that it won't happen to me again. There's a sense of, I need to do something to feel safe again. And when we start to, that toxic positivity, you know, well, it's all about feeling happy. And that happens inside of religious communities. And as you mentioned, inside of, spiritual communities as well, where we're not respecting the reality that we're mammals. We're not just, you know, minds. And it's not a matter of changing our story or our thoughts. It's about honoring that our body needs to feel safe in the world. And that's just, that's a different approach than, you know, just think different thoughts, be positive, you know, get over it. All of that can serve to undermine what a survivor really truly needs to feel safe again, which is to express their power, their aggression in a way that can change their internal sense of safety.
Shall we start taking questions?
I'm happy to. As you're asking questions, or asking four questions, let me just go ahead and kind of click through here and see if there's anything else that comes to mind here. I'll just kind of quickly go over these here. Again, this is reinforcing the idea that forgiveness is and revenge both are built-in features of human nature, and they've served important functions for us. And I think this one's important to make the world a more forgiving, less vengeful place. Don't try to change human nature. This is the think differently, feel differently, but we need to change the context, change the world. And I think, again, that's a really different approach to forgiveness than what is typical.
And most, you know, so many people don't even know that they have this, you know, they have other options, right?
This quote that I have on the screen right now, you know, highlights sometimes the approach that therapists was like, you know, we want people to feel better. We want them to get over things. We want them to like get beyond it, to move past it. And often I never use the F word in my sessions, which I'm referring to forgiveness. You know, it's not my place to encourage that, to promote that. If a client wants to explore that, I'm happy to join them in that process. However, in my opinion, the goal of therapy is never about helping people adjust to oppression. You know, just that the kind of just powerful. Get over it and go along.
I believe in choices.
You mentioned that you might want to talk about adverse religious experiences. I'm really passionate about and familiar with. I'm happy to kind of briefly touch on that if you think that would be useful.
Let's take a couple of questions.
Sure.
Oh, someone is asking, Daiksha, hopefully I'm pronouncing that right. She wants to know how to respond when someone says, she's referring to her toxic parents, they are hurting too. So, you know, that type of turning it around on, oh, well, I'm hurting too, or I was, you know, oftentimes we'll hear, well, I had trauma too,
A super, super common experience to have. And I believe in intergenerational trauma. I'm aware that trauma is passed on. And this question's a really challenging one. When I'm negotiating my own trauma and a person says, but what about them? Or what about this other person? It's like, well, that's a valid and appropriate conversation to have, but this is not the conversation to have that, right? We're focused on what do I need to feel safe and okay in the world again. When I do feel safe again, there's a context in which I can acknowledge that other people have suffered in ways too. When it's used as an excuse or a justification, and even though your parents may have done what they did to you as a result of their own unresolved trauma, nothing about that changes the fact that what happened to you was not okay. And I think when we can really focus on that, center that what I'm here to do my work, I need to do what I need to do to feel safe again. And if I'm able to, you know, process through my trauma and arrive at a place where I do feel safer, that's a context in which I can, you know, entertain the reality that others, you know, the people who harmed me were also harmed themselves. And, I think it's about how that functions more than is it true or not, or is it worth acknowledging or not. When that's being used to dismiss harmful behavior or to minimize harmful behavior, it's not functioning in a way that's healthy and okay for you. And so I think we can have, we can hold those two truths to be, you know, equal. Like, my parents were harmed in their childhood, and, you know, that certainly had an impact on how they treated me. And what happened to me was not okay. You know, those two things can exist at the same time. When we shift the focus to like, oh, well, they were harmed too, so, you know, I guess it just, this is how it goes. We just kind of pass on our trauma. We're not acknowledging that what's happening in this moment is I'm focusing on what I need to do to resolve my trauma, as opposed to, you know, focusing on someone else. It is challenging. I appreciate the polyvagal theory. And if we think about what a nervous system needs in order to feel, in order to connect with other humans, if I think about someone were really close to me and they're like pushing up against me, and I'm like, even as my hands are here now, I'm having the feeling of my breathing is more shallow. I don't quite feel as safe. And I know these are just my hands, but this felt sense is like, I don't feel safe here. If I wanted to connect and have a relationship with a person who's, you know, represents a threat to me, my nervous system won't allow me to do that because I need enough safety to connect. If I'm actively, aggressively in this, you know, fight or flight state, you know, defending, protecting myself, you know, if I'm trying to outrun a bear in the wild, you know, this conversation is not happening. I'm not considering, you know, other people's experiences and emotions, and the flowers disappear. And the only thing that matters is escaping to safety or defending myself. And so in that kind of activated fight or flight response, if I wanted to consider another person's experience and be able to have compassion and understanding for them, my nervous system is not in a place to allow me to do that. Absolutely. If we can aggressively, forcefully do what's necessary to be safe again, which sometimes is that cutting people off, pushing them away, doing what's necessary for us to be safe and okay. I can effectively neutralize that threat and I feel safe again, now there's a context in which connection can happen. And so if it's important to us and we think it's valuable to, you know, acknowledge that the person who harmed us was also harmed themselves, let's do everything we can to, you know, feel safe and okay ourselves. And then there's a possibility of exploring that. But otherwise, we're trying to ask our nervous system to do something it's just not equipped to do. We can't really connect when we're in these other survival responses.
Absolutely. Okay, a Facebook user is asking about, what about forgiveness of self?
I've been doing a series on my social media pages on Facebook and Instagram. And this question has come up several times, and I'm going to write about it because it's really important. I don't know exactly. I have not kind of formulated exactly how to address that, but I have a hunch that when we're forgiving ourselves, especially as a survivor of trauma, what is it that we're actually doing there? Because oftentimes what I think we mean by that is I'm blaming myself, I'm shaming myself, I'm taking responsibility for things that were out of my control, and maybe I have a very, you know, complicated relationship with my body and with you know, all these, this kind of internalized shame, and so I need to kind of forgive myself for this experience. I don't know that forgiveness is the word we're looking for here. I think if we were to even set aside the whole forgive myself concept and just begin to build up the concept of self-compassion, what does compassion look like when offered to myself? What do I need to feel safe and okay again? Can I acknowledge that I experienced something that was overwhelming to my nervous system and I couldn't handle that, and there's no shame there, there's no guilt there, there's no, that wasn't my fault. And that doesn't feel like I need to be forgiven for doing something wrong. That feels like I need to have compassion for this amazing nervous system that did what was necessary for my survival. And some of the work I do with trauma is acknowledging this really difficult thing to acknowledge, that while we would never want to experience freeze collapse in the face of something that overwhelmed us, there's a certain quality to that experience that that I'm grateful for, because mm-hmm. that's how I survived. That's why I'm here today. If I were to have tried to continue fighting when to fight would be, you know, to be annihilated, I wouldn't survive that. I'm grateful that my nervous system has the ability to freeze and collapse. Yes. It's a dark and disconnected place. I don't want to live there, but I'm glad it's an option for me, and I can feel some gratitude to that. So do I need to forgive myself for, you know, freeze collapse? So I need to forgive myself for, you know, blaming or shaming myself? Well, I don't know that forgiveness is what's required there. I think compassion is, and at least in my opinion, as far as what I've thought about this so far, I think compassion is probably a healthier and more kind of realistic approach there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. How do you know if you've experienced religious trauma as opposed to the garden variety shame mm-hmm. and rule-based religion?
And I that's a really great question. And, you know, as you mentioned earlier, I'm one of the co-founders of the Religious Trauma Institute. This is an area that I've been, you know, passionate about for a while. And I think there's some confusion about, like, what do we even mean by religious trauma? In the simplest terms, kind of religious trauma is trauma. And so then we need to ask the question, what is trauma? And we kind of briefly touched on that already, but it's that any experience that overwhelmed us, that was too much, too fast, we weren't able to handle it. Our nervous system didn't have the capacity to navigate that. Yeah. And then there's often the kind of lingering effects that are a result of that. I continue to feel powerless and trapped and stuck. I continue to feel on edge and hypervigilant. Mm-hmm. And so if you've experienced religious trauma as opposed to, you know, you've just been part of a high, you know, control group, and there was this rule governed behavior and the expectations, and there was maybe some shame on top of that. I think for me, it's not so much that we need to find this really precise diagnostic criteria as much as we need to notice, did my nervous system not have the capacity to handle that? And so, and each nervous system will be different. I think it's also worth noting that, you know, mm-hmm. three people can be in the same church, as it were, maybe three siblings in the same family. Mm-hmm. And one nervous system is overwhelmed and paralyzed. Another nervous system is activated and aggressive, and they can do what's necessary to defend themselves, and they feel strong, maybe. Another nervous system, you know, kind of tries to escape and avoid and run away. And so we're looking at what is not so much, you know, what is the event or the abuse, but what was my nervous system response? I'm grateful that as a trauma field, we're moving away from the definitions of trauma that exist in the event. It used to be that if you witnessed or experienced this kind of event, well, then we'll think of your experience as being trauma. And now we're recognizing that it's a combination of things. It's the internal and external resources. It's, you know, my history, what's happening in the moment. Am I alone, or do I have resources of others in that experience? And all these factors contribute to this, the experience being overwhelming or not. And so when it comes to, you know, how do I know whether it was trauma or not? I think we want to begin to look at what is your nervous system's response to the event. I think that's how I would respond to that. Yeah,
absolutely. And can you please touch on the difference between letting go versus forgiveness? That's a good one too.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what's being asked. I think, often when I talk about this topic, folks will say, oh yeah, but forgiveness isn't about, you know, restoration. It's not about, you know, reestablishing a relationship with the person who harmed you. And they're wanting to be very clear that forgiveness is just really about you feeling differently, or maybe as the question's being stated, like you letting go. I'm no longer kind of harboring this feeling of resentment or aggression towards this person. And I don't know. For me, I'm not as interested in the kind of labels that we put on that. Mm-hmm. Letting go might, for one person, be a completely different experience than forgiveness. And for another person, those two labels might be the exact same, you know, behavior or function. I think, again, if we think about what's required to let go or to forgive, mm-hmm. We still want to be noticing what's required in the environment, what needs to change, how can I feel safe enough, strong enough in order for it to be an option to let go? Because for me to let go when I'm still in a situation experiencing abuse, that's not going to be safe or functional for me. That's going to result in continued abuse. So again, I'm not sure what is meant by those two terms, letting go or forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of inherently difficult thing to talk about, because everyone has their own slightly different version of what forgiveness is. And again, I'm approaching this from more of a trauma-informed perspective. What's required for forgiveness to even be an option, or letting go, or whatever kind of word we want to use for that? I'm sorry if I'm not able to answer that as precisely as you'd like.
No, that's okay. Sure. Yeah, I think that I'll just kind of add, in my experience, that letting go, it kind of is in that same realm of, you know, oh, we'll just forgive and let go, or forgive and forget, or move on, get over it. It's kind of all of those statements in that one pot that are floating around, and that get thrown out there without the consideration for, you know, what some of the lived experiences are, and what's, you know, what that person's current situation is, all of those things. And again, it just goes back to that, that nervous system response, that level of safety, and just, you know, that's letting go without considering all of those other emotions and feelings and you know, things going on in the body.
Mm-hmm.
And that it would just be so easy. Well, that should be like, you know, wave your magic wand, it all goes away. And that's not how trauma works.
Yeah, sure.
Or our bodies, that's not how our bodies work.
Yeah. You know, Tracy, as you were adding to that, and I was thinking maybe reframing this idea of letting go. Mm-hmm. When it comes to feeling safe again, our nervous system trusting us again, often it requires us to do the assertive, aggressive, powerful thing. And so maybe instead of letting go, we could focus on pushing away, defending ourselves, doing the powerful, strong thing that we need to do in order to begin to trust ourselves again and to feel safe in our own bodies again. And to me, sometimes letting go, it evokes this idea of that kind of sigh of relief. You know, I am okay now. I'm safe. I'm at ease.
Yeah.
And I don't connect that to this forced thing that I'm trying to achieve. I connect that to, I've done the powerful, forceful thing. I've escaped to safety. I've neutralized the threat. And now I can be at ease. And so maybe, letting go when it's like, you need to achieve this or do this or somehow, you know, exert some effort to have this letting go experience, maybe instead focus on, how do I need to defend and protect myself? How do I need to renegotiate, resolve that trauma? And that often is a result of a more activated, forceful response.
All right, let me just see. Anybody else have questions? Let me just scroll through here. Let's see here. How can we express anger in a healthy way toward a parent?
Let me kind of click through here, because I said in the description that I'm hoping we could talk about maybe some alternatives to forgiveness that can also be helpful for us. So I can't really get into all this now. So I'm not going to do this justice because we don't have enough time to really dive into it deeply. But if we were to think about the kind of polyvagal theory arranged on a ladder, we're going to have this freeze collapse response, kind of this earlier part of the nervous system to evolve. And then later, we evolve this fight or flight response. This is kind of activated, aggressive. I can run faster, fight harder. My heart's beating fast. My blood's leaving the internal organs and moving to our arms and legs and, mobilizing our body to survive. And that's something that's, something that evolved as a result of us being mammals, right? Like this is a really important thing. The third part of the, up here at the top here, the safe and social branch of the nervous system of the polyvagal nerve is actually branching off of the dorsal vagal or the freeze collapse, response. And it shares in common this quality of being immobilized. When we freeze collapse under threat or when we're not safe, that's a very disconnected, immobilized, paralyzed kind of experience. When we experience safety inside of maybe a lover's embrace, we're also immobilized, but we're okay. It's a very safe and connected experience.
Yeah.
And so when we think about what's required for us to be safe again, and we're actually living down here inside of the freeze collapse response, this is a common place for survivors of trauma to exist. And we really want to feel safe and social at the top here.
Yeah.
From this kind of model here, our nervous system won't allow us to let our guard down again until we've gone into and through this fight or flight response.
And
I like to talk about this as maybe I've mentioned it here. So the dark side of forgiveness that exists down here in this this freeze collapse response, where we're being told or expected to do the thing that's not safe and okay for us, and it feels very powerless, and we feel stuck there. I've made a typo here, and what I want to add to this slide is aggression in the service of safety and the potential for connection. And when we think about how the aggressive fight or flight, this very powerful survival response, can allow us to move up this ladder to a place of feeling safe again, and we think, well, how can I, forgive my parents, or how can I have a safe relationship with them? It's going to require us to do the powerful, aggressive, forceful kinds of things, whether that's a very strong no contact kind of boundary, whether that's a you do not treat me that way, that it's not okay what you've said or done. And we feel this sense of strength and power and aggression that allows us to establish our own internal sense of safety. I mentioned before that if someone's kind of pressing up against us, we are, we can't really connect with them, even if we want to, because we're unsafe. Right. If we're actively, aggressively pushing them away and defending ourselves, we can't really connect in this activated fight or flight response. But if we can effectively push all the way out, no, you do not get to have access to me. No, you do not get to treat me this way. No, we're not talking about this topic. That is, I will not discuss that with you. This is a strong, powerful, I get to decide what works for me.
Yeah.
That allows us, again, that's the aggression in the service of safety. If there's any chance of establishing or reestablishing a relationship with someone who's harmed us, and I'm not saying that's the goal, but if there's any chance of establishing that, we ourselves need to feel safe first. And how I understand trauma and how we can regain a sense of safety, our body won't let us feel safe until it knows we can defend and protect ourselves again, and kind of resolve that that unresolved experience where I needed to do something to protect myself, but I was unable to. And then what my nervous system learned about my experience was I'm powerless. I can't do what's necessary to defend myself. And I become kind of trapped and stuck inside of this freeze collapse response. And so you know, again, society doesn't really support this idea right. of anger and aggression being a really helpful and healthy way of you know, creating a context where connection is possible. And I think even as survivors who have lived inside of freeze collapse mm-hmm. often, because that's a very stuck place, as it were, and yeah. the impression is, well, if I go into this angry place, well, then I'll just become this angry, bitter person, and I don't want to live like that. And yeah. and so it feels risky. But if we think about what's required to survive a situation where a threat arises, if, you know, a mountain lion appears in my room out of nowhere, I'm not going to feel safe until something's done about that. And if I were to aggressively, powerfully escape to safety or defend myself, and, you know, the mountain lion is gone and I'm okay again, I'm not going to continue to feel angry. I'm not going to continue to feel aggressive. I'm going to, like,
right.
oh, there'll be this kind of, you know, settling in after that, you know, survival energy showed up and I escaped, or I'm safe again. And that's going to kind of just dissipate. And then I'm going to, you know, feel like I can be safe in my house again. And yeah. and how do we do that? Well, it really requires this middle state here. Mm. And so I think in terms of how do we create a context that gives us the best chance, you know, I think it's likely going to be a result of doing the powerful, forceful things that are required to feel safe again.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And just all of those yeah. layers
mm-hmm.
of yeah. feelings or emotions that we mm-hmm. never got to express.
Yeah. Yeah. And as a result, we don't trust ourselves. I think if we've never been allowed to experience anger in a way mm-hmm. that served a purpose and was yeah. effective in helping us survive,
yeah.
it's really hard to trust it. I mean, it's a really powerful experience.
It is.
You know,
yeah.
if you've ever had that fight or flight response, you know, it's like, whoa, this is intense. My whole body is transforming yeah. in this, you know, really strong and powerful way. And that can
Absolutely.
Feel very unsettling. And so we want to create context in which folks can do that in a more systematic way, in a more intentional mm-hmm. in a way where there's enough safety around them. And I think that's why
yeah.
we're working with a really, you know,
that's why we
skilled trauma.
We titrate that.
Yeah. Yeah. yeah, for sure. Yep.
Yeah. Absolutely. Because yeah. it's too much. Let's see. Looking through here, let's questions. Guilt and shame related to having needs, wants, and desires. Only, I guess that's not really. I'm not sure. Only.
Yeah. I'm actually seeing
sure
that question
that's
now.
A question or not?
Yeah. So I think in growing up inside of religion, this question may make more sense to me than
yeah.
you. So the kind of self-sacrificial way of living that. If I just do for others instead of myself, that then, you know, somehow that's apprised or considered, you know, what's expected of us in certain communities. And when we think about where, if we were to kind of put that back on the ladder here, where does that exist? You know, where does this, my needs don't matter, other people's needs are more important than my own? You know, especially in patriarchal religious systems, you know, this idea of submitting or being submissive to another human in order to survive, you know, the community itself can value that, can even reward that. You get to be part of this group. If you're, you know, if you're small enough and powerless enough, you can survive here. But again, that's surviving inside of this, you know, freeze collapse response, you know, this please and appease response. I don't actually get to be safe. I get to exist, but I don't get to be safe.
Wow.
And when we recognize that, it's a really powerful thing. And I think this is, you know, why I'm super passionate about religious trauma is because in my own experience and in the experience of so many survivors who I've worked with, almost all of their religious experience was inside of survival physiology. They were never able to object, to defend themselves, to say, this doesn't work for me, this is not okay. They felt forced to do what was required. And so, I think when it comes to this kind of, you know, self-sacrificial way of living. And when we kind of prioritize that or value that as a community, what is it that we're actually doing? Well, we're saying you don't get to be safe in the world. You only get to survive. And here's what's required. You have to become small enough, powerless enough, self-giving enough. And yeah, it's an incredibly toxic experience.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. So many great whew. Questions here. Yeah.
Good questions. Okay. Dayaksha, thank you so much for joining us. She's in South Africa.
Oh, so amazing. Yeah. Thanks for being here.
Yeah. Thank you. Let's see what else.
Let me just see what other things I have here. Yeah. Let's kind of click through here as you're looking there.
I'm going to look on my phone. It's a little easier.
I think we've touched on this a bit as well. Feel free to interrupt with a question as well. This idea of identity trauma or somatic shame, often connected with trauma survivors, especially folks who have experienced religious trauma. It's this deeply held experience of chronic shame that really lives in our body. It becomes like who we are in the world, and often connected, like I said, to trauma as well.
Absolutely. And I think the thing about shame is, you know, it's so hard to put words to what it is, right? Mm-hmm. It's just like this, this wordless, how do we even know if some of our coping mechanisms or things that we're doing are based in shame, right?
Yeah. I wanted to touch on this then. It's such a great question. I invite folks to go to my Facebook page and read the post that I shared probably two or three weeks ago now on is there an adaptive function to shame? And I was listening to Gabor Maté and what's his name? Dr. Lawrence, I think. His name's eluding me at the moment. Anyhow, they were having this conversation and they were kind of exploring this question, what's the adaptive function of shame? And Gabor Maté makes a really, really important, offers a really important insight. And he said, imagine you're a 3-year-old and your dad is yelling at your mom. Is it, and obviously you're feeling very unsafe as a very young nervous system. Is it better for you to believe that my parents are incapable of caring for me, that they're unsafe, that they're harmful? Or is it better to believe that it must be my fault, or there's something wrong with me, or this kind of internalized shame? And if they were to believe the former, if they were to believe that my parents are incapable of caring for me, they're not safe for me, that would require them to just abandon everything they know about the world. That would require them to kind of sacrifice any form of attachment that they had to that point. It would change everything for them. And so to turn that against ourselves, even though it clearly isn't their fault, but what we're trying to do in that moment, and this is why it's adaptive from a survival perspective, if I can blame myself, then I'm holding on to the hope that maybe I can change. Maybe I can do something to regain a sense of safety and love in the world. Maybe I can still maintain a belief that my parents aren't horrible humans who don't care about me. Yeah. And so when we make that, it's a subconscious, decision in that moment. It's not a choice. Yeah. But when faced with, do I change or abandon everything I know about how the world works, or do I blame myself? Like, it's more adaptive from a survival perspective to blame ourselves. Now, that does result in this, internalized shame, and it's incredibly painful and difficult to live inside of that. But when we think about why that happens, why that exists, then it makes sense. At least we can recognize that our bodies did what were necessary to navigate a situation where we had no control, and to blame ourselves was a way of kind of trying to salvage this idea of connection and love in the world. It's devastating. It's incredibly difficult to contemplate how you know painful that is for a child or anyone really to experience that. Absolutely. And yet to see it through that adaptive lens can provide you know, at least some understanding of why we did that. You mentioned shame being this kind of wordless experience. I work with shame from a body perspective, and you know, just kind of leaning forward, the shoulders in a bit, kind of caved in feeling in our chest, maybe a bit of emptiness in our gut, and noticing what that feels like, and then leaning back and noticing what that feels like. Really beginning to notice that embodied sense of shame. Yeah. And if we can begin to give our body what it needs to feel a bit stronger, you know, and more connected, there's potential to begin to resolve some of that shame, more so than if we are trying to convince ourselves that, you know, with positive talk and whatnot, that, you know, things aren't as bad as you think they are, and, you know, you're better than you think you are. And this, you know, kind of trying to reassure ourselves to change our story. Our body doesn't speak English. Our body doesn't use words or language. Our body is primarily focused on sensations and survival. And so if we can begin to work with shame from that perspective, it can be helpful. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, that shame really lives in the body.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Good stuff. Good stuff.
I feel like we could talk all day.
I know. Yeah.
So many great comments and questions here. Yeah.
Wrap it up.
Yeah. I wanted to point out, you know, the Religious Trauma Institute.
Yes.
We're a fairly new organization. We have clinical trainings lined up for therapists who work with trauma and want to understand religious trauma so they can more effectively support survivors. And so we're focusing on that, providing some psychoeducational workshops for survivors. We're working with graduate students and academic researchers who want to study this topic as well. We have a lot of things planned for the Institute, and we're really excited about that. It's, like I said, it's fairly new. But if folks want to follow that on our social media, they can also sign up for our email list as well for updates. And then, here's my contact information here. So folks can have access to that.
If we missed your question, can you ask it again? Would that be okay if you don't mind? Somebody, because it's kind of hard to scroll back through now through all the comments. So if you had a last question, if you don't mind posting it again.
I'm not able to see what question they ask because all I see is Facebook user on my side here, so I'm not sure. Yeah, if you want to copy and paste that back in here, I'm happy to respond.
Yeah.
To. Yeah.
Hold on a second.
While they're posting that.
If you can copy and paste it back in there.
Yeah. Paul Vega. Let me scroll up here. I think I did see a question. Not being able to defend myself, feeling trapped, freeze, drop. I'm still seeking safety and safe person that won't turn on me as they all do. I
think
we did touch on that a bit when we talked about the polyvagal theory. And so you might want to watch the replay of the video. But in terms of, I can't really speak to your specific individual experience, but I would encourage anyone who is feeling trapped and stuck inside of a survival response to seek out a therapist who's familiar with the nervous system and is not just your typical talk therapist who wants to process through trauma in a cognitive space, and to notice what does your body need to feel safe and okay again. And when we start with kind of increasing our awareness of our body, which is not easy at first, it can be quite difficult because we've been so disconnected for so long. But as we notice the sensations that we're feeling around certain mm-hmm. experiences, often there are kind of clues in there as to what our nervous system needs to do in response.
Yeah.
To feel safe again. If I'm feeling this kind of pressing down, this heaviness, this constriction, I'm not able to move freely, there might need to be a pushing out or a moving in some way. And as we begin to notice that and become more sensitive to that and begin to trust that, I'm physically feeling trapped and stuck and not safe. What do I need to do to feel just a little bit safer? And I'm careful to use that word as opposed to safe, you know, but just to feel a little bit safer,
a little
bit stronger. How can we begin to notice that? Can I trust that? Can I push a bit more? You know, we've talked about this kind of big, strong, aggressive pushing away and neutralizing a threat, feeling safe again. I'll talk to people about, like, you know, when you decline an offer to do something that maybe you could go either way. A friend says, hey, I want to go eat at this restaurant. And you're just like, I could take it or leave it, but I really don't prefer this restaurant. Can you say, no, I don't want to go there? And just push your hand out a bit, have this kind of more embodied, connected experience. I can say no and be okay. Yeah. Often when we've, you know, survived trauma, we don't know what it feels like to say no and that to be okay. And so to begin to do that in small ways, so that our body can begin to trust us again, then there can be bigger no's and bigger pushing away. And there's so much there. And again, it's hard to conceptualize, you know, 6 months of therapy and a short two-sentence answer. But I would certainly encourage folks to begin looking at, you know, what does your nervous system need and working with folks who are able to support that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And any last, a couple of people said, you know, what do you say? And I don't know if you can answer this, but you know, what do you say to people that say, oh, well, just, you know, forgive your parent, you should reconcile, or, and, you know, that might be something you hear in any container at a church or what have you, but, you know, when people are constantly pressuring you, or you hear that in society from even just friends and, you know, what do you do with that?
So I think that would vary from person to person and situation to situation. Sure. However, I think what often is part of that pressure to forgive, you know, why don't you just forgive? Why don't you get over this? It's almost like this is going to become a debate about whether forgiveness is healthy or not, whether forgiveness is expected or not. Yeah. And if you were to say, you know, well, actually, I'm not ready to forgive and that's not healthy for me. And they come back with, but you're supposed to, and, you know, God can help you forgive and just get over it. And, you know, what do you need to do to forgive? And now we're having a conversation about, you know, is forgiveness good or bad? You know, is it right or wrong? Is it useful or not useful? And, in my experience, that's not a very helpful conversation to have with someone who probably has pretty strong ideas about, like, you just got to forgive. I'm not going to convince them that's not true for me. However, we can say, and I use this with folks who maybe have exited a religion and their well-intentioned friends and family are trying to bring them back into, you know, proselytize them again and, you know, have debates and arguments with them about theology and so forth. I think a really helpful response in those situations are, it just doesn't work for me. But that doesn't work for me. There's really no way have a debate around that, because if they were to say, but it does work for you, you know, they're claiming to know what works for you. And really, you're the only one who knows what works for you. It's not sidestepping the question. It's not saying, I don't just want to talk about it, although that's a perfectly acceptable response. And you could say in a very forceful way, that's not something I'm willing to talk to you about, or that's not okay to discuss that with me. You can do that.
Yeah.
I think, what may feel more accessible to a survivor who maybe isn't really familiar or comfortable inside of the activated state and setting a strong boundary, simply saying that doesn't work for me. And just, you know, not getting pulled into you know, the benefits of forgiveness and why it's going to be helpful for you and, you know, why it's so important, and just say, well, it just doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
And, you know, you could even say it doesn't work for me right now if you wanted to maybe soften that a bit. You know, but yeah, I think that there is, and part of that is, do you respect me enough to trust that I know what works for me? And if you don't, well, then I'm going to set a harder boundary, and I'm going to push you away even more, because that's not okay for you to judge me in this way, in a way that's not healthy for me. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Really powerful. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we've been going on for a while.
Oh, goodness. And the time has flown by.
So, yeah, it's been absolutely amazing, really powerful, and so, so informative. But I think we're going to wrap it up let people, and hopefully I'm going to post your info in the group again.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
And then if anybody is watching the replay, Brian's info is on here. This is going to, you know, this will end up in the group as a replay to watch. I think that's about it. Oh, Brian, awesome. I want to thank you so much.
Yeah. It truly is my pleasure. Yeah.
I'm just honored that you spent this time with us and, you know, took the time to really talk about this.
This
is so, so important.
Yeah.
And I maybe love to have you back down the road,
because
I feel like we just are scratching the surface.
I'm feeling the same way for sure. Yeah. And I want to just thank you so much as well, Tracy. And when I think about the beautiful gift that you're giving the folks in your group, creating a context where it's safe enough to process through some things, I'm so honored to support that in this small way, and grateful for the work that you're doing. Yeah.
Yeah. Likewise. Yeah. Wonderful. Good stuff. Thank you again. And thank you everyone for joining and taking your time out of your day, for wherever you are in the world, for joining us. If you can watch the replay, you know, feel free to, you know, start from the beginning. If you came in halfway, that kind of thing, it will be up in the group for you to watch. And we really appreciate everyone being here in this container today. So thanks again, Brian.
Yeah.
And
thank you, Tracy.
Shall sign off then.
All right.
Okay.
Take care. So long.
All right. Bye, everybody. Bye. Thanks again.